BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello and welcome to How They Made Us Doubt Everything. Episode 7, The Opponent.
You wonder whether you've ever seen a green economy of the sort that our great Hopemeister is discussing to the nation. Well, we have. Put your hate and skepticism aside for a minute and do realize we have seen green economies before, and we've seen them function quite nicely. We saw them in the 13th century.
If you are looking for someone to convince people that climate change is nothing to worry about, then Jerry Taylor's your man.
Nobody needs to force Detroit to make fuel-efficient cars. They're there if you want to buy them. The problem that Dan has is that most consumers don't particularly care to buy them. They care to buy other sorts of things.
The problem is, Jerry, you can't buy an SUV.
My job at the Cato Institute was to make the strongest argument I possibly could against climate action.
In the 1990s, Jerry Taylor leads the free market think tank Cato Institute's work on energy policy.
If you believe the narratives of mainstream climate science, then it suggests the government needs to act extremely aggressively and interfere in free markets to address the problem. Libertarians don't want that.
The Cato Institute advocates for minimal regulation of business, and that makes them a natural ally of those arguing against government action on climate change. In order to make these arguments, Jerry would cite the likes of Fred Singer and Fred Seitz in his policy papers and on TV. They're the physicists we heard about in previous episodes, who first worked to spread doubt over the connection between smoking and lung cancer, and then spread doubt about climate change. But what makes Jerry special is that in this battle for hearts and minds, performance is everything. And this guy, he's got it.
I was on Fox News and MSNBC and CNN, talk radios. I would tour the nation and speak in front of college campuses, often in debates.
What makes somebody good at TV, especially for something as complex as climate change? I mean, what were you good at?
Well, what makes somebody a good actor? It's the same thing. Do they smile? Do they have a good demeanor? Is their body language fine? Are they cool under fire? Do they get nervous in front of a camera? Do they think fast? Can they think on their feet? Are they colorful? Do they have a sense of humor? Are they good with language?
And what about you personally? Is that something that you were and I suppose remain good at?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very good at it.
And just to be clear, your personal background, you're not a scientist.
No, I'm not. Well, in fact, I don't have a college degree, but for the most part, I studied political science.
And who was Jerry up against?
There are uncertainties because there were certain kinds of phenomena that were included in the model.
Well, for example, a lot of the time, he was up against actual climate scientists. And as I've been finding out while making this show, the sort of slick communication Jerry is a master of is not exactly their forte. This is Marty Huffert, one of the first scientists to predict climate change.
For example, the impact of cloudiness that were very hard to model. They could be modeled, but it would be very hard to reproduce the effects in computers.
Because sometimes it can feel as if they're talking a different language. We're going to need some help.
I'm Susan Joy Hassel, and I translate science into English.
My name is Peter Pomerantsev, and for BBC Radio 4, this is How They Made Us Doubt Everything. This is a series about how some of the world's most powerful interests made us doubt the connection between smoking and cancer, and how similar tactics were used by some to make us doubt climate change. The scientists may have had the facts on their side, but did the facts ever really stand a chance? Susan Hassel is a specialist in how to communicate science to people like, people like you and me. In the 1990s, she was working for the US government as a lead writer on key climate change research reports. That wasn't easy.
All these scientists were just wonderful. They were very serious about their work. They did not think much about the communication.
Susan Hassel quickly discovered that scientists literally use words differently to the rest of us.
So, for example, when a scientist says positive, he doesn't mean good. To the public, positive means good, right? But when the scientist says it's a positive trend, it's not a good trend. It's an upward trend. So a positive trend in global temperature, that's global warming. But to the public, positive sounds good. So that's just one example. You know, another example is when they say uncertainty, they are not talking about not knowing, right? To the public, uncertainty means we just don't know.
So just to be clear, what does uncertainty mean to a scientist? Because in my head, it also means uncertainty. You're not certain. I mean, you can't have uncertainty about the word uncertainty.
Yes. So nothing is ever 100% certain in science.
Okay.
Right? The scientists use uncertainty to talk about a range around a particular measurement or projection. So they'll call the uncertainty range between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees Celsius, for example, is the uncertainty range for climate sensitivity. But they're as certain that humans are causing global warming as we are that cigarette smoking causes lung cancer. And they don't realize sometimes that when they continue to emphasize uncertainties, they're giving people the wrong impression. And so I think the deniers take advantage of that.
Well, more than just take advantage. The whole strategy to undermine the science around climate change has been to emphasize uncertainty.
Victory will be achieved when average citizens understand uncertainties in climate science.
The strategy to emphasize uncertainty now seems like a really clever way of using the language of scientists against them.
Yeah, theory is one of my pet peeve words that I wish scientists would stop using. So they use it for two things. They use it to mean something that's very well established in science and can be used to make predictions, like the theory of gravity.
That's just the theory, though.
If that was just a theory, we'd all be floating around, right? So the theory of human-induced global warming, we know that. It's solid. It's as solid as the theory of gravity. So, but to the public, it's just a hunch or a guess. So those who seek to confuse the public and pretend that this is not real and is not scientific fact constantly will use that. Oh, it's only a theory.
This reminds me of a line from one of the memos that we've heard before.
Reposition global warming as theory, not fact.
Now I'm thinking about it. Doesn't that actually play into exactly the way scientists talk already, kind of exploits their language?
Absolutely.
So just to be clear, us ordinary people call a theory what we consider to be uncertain, while what scientists call a theory is what they consider certain, whilst what they call uncertain is not really uncertain at all. Now, look, if you find that a touch topsy-turvy, you just wait until we get to the innocent-sounding word, likely.
All the evidence suggests that something is going to happen, but we can't say it will happen. What do we say then? So let's make a lexicon. We'll say if we think it's more than 90%, we'll say very likely. And if we think it's more than 66%, we'll say likely.
So, Susan, I mean, I guess it's, I don't know, because I'm English, but if I tell someone I'm very likely to come to their party, that's my polite way of saying I'm not coming. I mean, you know, very likely is just so weak. It's just not a strong word. Why didn't you say 90%? There's a 90% chance. Isn't that stronger?
We talked about using numbers, and they felt that it was too precise.
That oh, no.
We couldn't get that precise. You can't say it's 90% or 91% or 67%. So we wanted to say something softer, but I have to agree with you. And I told them that I was afraid that likely was not a very strong word. And what happened is that the IPCC ended up making it even more complicated and adding even more words and levels. And I said, oh, my God, this is not going to work. People are going to think we don't know anything. And we're really underselling the science here.
And what did they say?
They said, well, we'll just tell them, you know, we'll just explain to people this is the way we use this word. And I was like, no, you can't. Well, they said, well, we'll make a glossary and we'll put it in the glossary the way we mean it. And I said, no, no, nobody's going to read the glossary. We can't be like the quintessential American tourist in Paris thinking that we can just speak our own language more slowly and loudly, and they will understand us because they won't.
And where is the beach?
And they thought, oh, I'm trying to get them to dumb it down. And I said, no, it's not dumbing down. It's smartening up. The only thing that's dumb is speaking to people in a language that they don't understand. And the problem was that the deniers were doing media training all the time.
What sort of media work would have been done with the actual climate scientists sort of back in sort of the 90s and early 2000s and that kind of period?
None, really.
Yes, that's right. In 2000, the year Susan's key climate change report was due to come out, the main oil companies spent $150 million on corporate promotion. Meanwhile, the country's best climate change scientists, well, they weren't even doing media training.
So I think it is a kind of tragedy, actually. I think part of the reason we are in the situation we are in today with climate change, where we've had 50 years of good scientific work and bad scientific communication.
This is Naomi Oreskes, a historian of science at the University of Harvard and author of Merchants of Doubt.
And the best I could say to defend scientists is to say they didn't realize what they were up against. They didn't understand that this was a politically motivated, highly financed, highly professional campaign. So when they began to realize that there were these weird things being said, they did what scientists do, which is to publish more scientific data, to publish more peer-reviewed articles, to write longer reports with more data and more graphs. And we've seen this. Yeah, you know, you're
laughing.
That'll
really get
them,
but that'll get the audience.
Right. I know, you know, because you're a journalist and you know that that doesn't work. But you have to remember, they're working a whole different framework. I mean, a way you can think of scientists as being innocents, like children. And there's something sort of charming about it, but also heartbreaking, right? Like when children believe in magic, scientists believe in facts. And they think that if you just get enough of them, people will understand. And what we've come to see in the last 50 years is that's just sadly not true.
So how can you win a war when you're fighting on a totally different battlefield? Scientists were fighting in the peer-reviewed literature for so long, they didn't even realize they were getting their asses whooped where it mattered. Once Susan Hassell realized the scale of the problem, she did try to get scientists to up their communication game.
As time went on, we got a little bit more savvy and we tried to do some training and thinking through, okay, you got to come up with 3 points.
But compared to Jerry Taylor, the skilled TV performer who's making the case against climate action, you know, these scientists who are trying to remember their 3 points, I don't know, it's like the equivalent of me trying to compete with, I don't know, Lionel Messi at kick-ups.
I wasn't trying to remember my 3 talking points. That's how to survive, but it's not how to thrive. If you want to be good on TV, you've got to be able to take advantage of openings. And I was pretty darn good at that sort of thing. I'm very relaxed in front of a camera, and I hardly ever lost a debate.
But that was about to change. Jerry is going to find out that even though the camera loves him, he's actually being duped. How They Made Us Doubt Everything is produced by Phoebe Keane. It was mixed by Rod Farker, and the editor is Ravin Sampat. If you liked it, tell a friend, rate or review the podcast, and thanks for listening.